Good morning, everybody, and welcome back to Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. If you're looking for something to do this afternoon, after you listen to the show, of course, International Wildlife Museum is having their Outdoors Day today. Actually, it's going on right now from 10 till 2 this afternoon, so you still have time to check it out. Admission is only $4 today, and they're having all kinds of events going on. If you haven't been there before, this is a great opportunity to check it out. Great day for it out there. Kids will love it, and it's a great learning opportunity for everybody. And we want to learn from you, so we want to hear from you. So give us a call, because there, by no stretch of the imagination do I know everything or have all the wisdom, knowledge, and understanding of King Solomon. Far from it. Fred's out this week trying to recover from whatever disease is going around out there, so hopefully he's doing better. But as usual, Oscar's here.
Yeah, he picked up a sickness from the wallabies.
Oh, that's what it was.
In Australia.
That could be. number 520-750-7456. If you want to call in and join us in the conversation, if you want to hear any of the past shows, they're available on the website, SolomonOnBlast.com. If you can't be around the radio and you want to listen in, you can always stream us live. Just go to PowerTalk1210.com and click on the Listen Live button there. Solomon says in the first chapter of the book of Proverbs that the book is for specifically for people a direction for their lives to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man, knowledge and discretion. A wise man will hear and increase learning. Increased learning is what we should be spending our whole lives doing. From our learning comes knowledge, then understanding, and eventually wisdom. And our learning shouldn't stop when we're done with school, obviously, especially in today's world. With the internet, we have all kinds of information available to educate ourselves. But what we are really learning is what matters. It's what we spend our time learning that's significant, because what we learn directs our beliefs and ultimately our behavior. And the question I have is, what happens in a culture where kids aren't being taught moral virtues? The things that used to keep people in check, the corrosiveness of the culture today has dissolved those limits and sanctions that people once had as regular habits in their lives. So it's impossible for somebody taught these morals to be able to command that morality in those that weren't taught it, and it not being part of their beliefs. There's evidence of this in the news constantly. So instead of commanding, we have to be able to persuade. And to persuade them, we have to be able to show that the path we advocate is not arbitrary, and it's not something they have to submit to, but it's a path that leads to life and that they would freely choose if they clearly understood it. That's the learning that must occur. It's like learning to trust that voice in the GPS navigation system when we're commanded to turn left at the next intersection. It doesn't make any sense to us. We would freely choose to turn left if we understood the path that leads to our destination. We must be able to show that biblical moral behaviors lead to life, and not having those behaviors leads to much worse things. We have to be able to explain the mark at which they are to aim. It's not an easy task, and we run the risk of being irrelevant or even worse, dangerous, if our teaching does not give a true account of the path to follow among all those possible choices. Just like that GPS system, we have to provide the right directions. Otherwise, they'll end up lost, and we don't want that. God forbid. So we'll continue. Solomon on Blast, right after these commercial breaks. We'll be right back.
I've had choices since the day that I was born. There were voices that told me right from wrong. If I had listened, no, I wouldn't be here today. with the choices I've made. I was tempted, losing and dying with the choices I've made. I was tempted. By an early age, I found I liked drinking. Oh, and I never turned it down. There were loved ones, but I turned them all away. Now I'm living and dying with the choices I've made.
Okay, we're back here on Solomon on Blast. Choices that we make. Well, according to this article, Ben Carson says being gay is a choice. Same-sex couples don't get to redefine marriage. That occurred in an interview that he had on CNN with Chris Cuomo. And Carson says it's not the same situation because people have no control over their race. When Carson's commented to him about that same-sex couples' marriage was akin to racism. And when asked if he believed being gay is a choice, Carson responded that absolutely. He added, because a lot of people who go into prison straight, and when they come out, they're gay. So did something happen while they were in there? Ask yourself that question. Well, Proverbs says the heart of the wise teaches his mouth and adds learning to his lips. And it turns out that Ben Carson took a lot of flack for making those statements. He said, he also stated in the interview that each state should be able to decide what marriage is for residents of that region and argued it's possible to grant legal rights that accompany marriage to same-sex couples without applying the word marriage to their relationships. And I think he's pretty on point there, because if you really look at it, and he says, why do gay people want to get married? Why do they want to say they want to get married? Because they want to have various rights, property rights, visitation rights. He said, why can't any two human beings, I don't care what their sexual orientation is, why can't they have the legal right to do those things? That does not require changing the definition of marriage. And that's true, because marriage, if you really look at it, is an institution of the church, instituted by God, not by man. So for them to redefine marriage, in at least from what I've thought about, is no different than the people that want to keep that separation of church and state. Well, they're going against their own beliefs of separation of church and state if they believe that the state can be involved in defining what marriage is and what it isn't. That's a church institution. Then the church is the one that should be defining that, and the state shouldn't be involved in it.
Especially when you have the further, more liberal voices saying that eventually the government will have to, in order to keep things equal and fair, force churches to to perform
those marriages
in church. Yeah. I mean, that's a clear violation of that.
Yeah, and so there has to be that clear separation of church and state, a true separation of church and state, not what the people want to make it out to be that are typically throwing it around. So it's kind of hypocritical from that aspect that they're so adamant that they redefine marriage when especially from a state or federal point of view, when in reality it is not something that the state ever created. Later that week, after making those comments, like the next day, he issued an apology for his words, saying they do not fully reflect his heart on gay issues. He said, I do not pretend to know how every individual came to their sexual orientation. I regret that my words to express that concept were hurtful and divisive. For that, I apologize unreservedly to all those who were offended. And he says that, in referencing his medical education and work at Johns Hopkins, he backtracked, saying science has not yet proven whether people are born either gay or straight. He says some of our brightest minds have looked at this debate, and up till this point, there have been no definitive studies that people are born into a specific sexuality. He says, we do know, however, we are always born male or female, and I know we're all made in God's image, which means we're all deserving of respect and dignity. And I think that's absolutely true, that we're all born, created from God's image. And one guy that I know, a friend of mine from church, he made the comment when he's gone out and people have said, you know, well, I'm born this way with regards to being gay. He said, that's the reason why Jesus said you must be born again, is because we are born into that sinful nature and we have corruption. And I think if Ben Carson may have had that little tidbit in hand there, he could have answered much differently than he did in that interview. But one of the things that has come out of it, he says that in his concluding statements, he admitted he'd previously discussed gay people without properly considering his words. He says, no excuses. I deeply regret my statement. I promise you, on this journey, I may err again. But unlike politicians, when I make an error, I will take full responsibility and never hide or parse words. And that's kind of why I said Proverbs, the heart of the wise teaches his mouth and adds learning to his lips. Ben's pretty good about coming back out and saying, I've learned from what I've said, and I will be a little bit more careful. And actually, at one point in some of the discussion, he said that he's not going to address the issue with regards to gays anymore, because it seems to be that the interviewers always try and pull him into an area where they can basically end up.
He's afraid of being bullied. Of being bullied. I mean,
yeah, he's basically saying he doesn't want to go into that environment where they can just turn around and bully him for everything he said.
He didn't say, I mean, I don't think he said a factual error. And no. Yet he's apologizing as if he did. So I think, you know, he's feeling the full force of the bully, you know, the bullying side of the gay rights movement upon him.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that here's a guy, a neurosurgeon, that you would expect would have some level of respect from the people in terms of his medical understanding of the human body, especially the brain, being a neurosurgeon. So the question is it more just the fact that he's a Christian, and that's what we have to be careful of in terms of when we say things. Yeah. Like I said at the beginning, when you can't command people to believe something if their belief system was based on something entirely different. And in our culture today, that original belief system that this country was founded on is fast fading away.
It's funny because I think they want us to believe blindly that that statement is true, that people are born gay or whatever. And the truth is, nobody's born anything.
Male or female, and then they'll turn around and say,
yeah, but nobody's born anything sexual. I mean, it's something that you pick up later on, and you know, and people continue to evolve even within their heterosexuality. You know, it's whatever. I think the only statement that maybe is wrong is that some people don't have a choice. Maybe don't people have control over sexuality, but I don't think people are born anything. I don't think people are born gay or straight.
No. Okay, we'll be back after these commercials.
BRLFQ spells mom and dad. Well, that ain't too bad, cause that's my boy. Well, you can have your TV and your nightclubs, and you can have your driving picture show. There he sits with a pen and a yellow pad. What a handsome lad.
That's my boy. B-R-L-F-Q spells mom and dad. Well, that ain't too bad, 'cause that's my boy. Well, you can have your TV and your nightclubs.
Okay, we're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. And Proverbs says, "Hear my children the instruction of a father and give attention to no understanding, for I give you good doctrine. Do not forsake my law." Well, according to this article, atheist Richard Dawkins says, "Children with religious parents must be protected from indoctrination and becoming idiots." The article says that Richard Dawkins, who is a prominent atheist and author of the book The God Delusion, he sparked controversy over promoting the notion that children with religious parents must be protected from indoctrination. The 73-year-old's comments were made in defense of a campaign by predominantly atheist Ireland to overhaul the country's education system. There's a balancing act, and you have to balance the rights of parents and the rights of children. I think that balance has swung too far towards parents, Dawkins told the Irish Times. So I wonder whether they asked him to retract his comments with regards to that, because to say that children shouldn't be raised and educated by their parents, but instead by the educational system, goes pretty far over the edge there. He says less than a week prior, he also wrote The Selfish Gene. Dawkins, who also wrote The Selfish Gene, released a blog post on Time entitled "Don't Force Your Religious Opinions on Your Children." In the op-ed, he argued that children are being saddled with religious labels in a way they never would be with certain political opinions. Responding to a recent case in London concerning the banning of pork products for primary school dinners so that certain children would not be forced to eat food that violate their beliefs, Dawkins writes, "How can the beliefs of a four-year-old child be important to her if she doesn't even know what her beliefs are?" And he says, "Would you ever speak of a four-year-old's political beliefs? Hannah's a socialist, four-year-old, Mark a conservative. Who would ever dream of saying such a thing?" He says, "Religion is the one exception we all make to the rule. Don't label children with the opinion of their parents," he writes. Well, I would ask him in response is, what should we indoctrinate our children into? The atheism that he likes to promote, which says that there are no rules, there are no absolutes in the world. It just seems to be that he can get away with making comments like this that are just totally out there, off the wall. Nobody's asking for his apology, and nobody's asking him to retract what he says, when in some cases this is just as inflammatory as, or more so than, what Ben Carson commented about. And he says when Dawkins says when parents force their religious opinions on their children, the children are prevented from properly thinking for themselves or escaping their idiot child role. He adds that many of his Jewish friends, almost all atheists, and now wait a minute, is there a little bit of a contradiction there that he's got Jewish friends, but they're almost all atheists? So where does that come into? He says they all enjoy celebrating traditional festivals, and he himself, he says, is not opposed to attending cathedral carol services and harvest festivals in country churches. He says tradition is fine where it amounts to songs or literature, styles of dress or architecture, but tradition is a terrible basis for ethics or beliefs about the origin of the universe or the evolution of life. So here we have tradition, i.e. having a set of morals and beliefs that, when you grow up, provide a much more stable society. being defined as a terrible basis for ethics and a belief about the origin of the universe. He has a belief he's trying to indoctrinate people with. Is it any different than the parents that have the right to educate their children whatever way they want versus the state doing it? I'd say he's way, way out there, out in left field. Looks like we've got to take a break. We'll come back with more of Solomon on Blast right after these commercial messages.
Making a castle out of building blocks.
Okay, we're back. Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. Along those same lines, there was a opinion article in the New York Times by a gentleman by the name of Justin McBrayer. He says, why our children don't think there are moral facts. In his opinion article, he says, what would you say if you found out that our public schools were teaching children that it is not true that it's wrong to kill people or for fun or cheat on tests? Would you be surprised? Well, he says he was. He says, as a philosopher, I already knew that many college-age students don't believe in moral facts. While there are no national surveys quantifying this phenomenon, philosophy professors with whom I have spoken suggest that the overwhelming majority of college freshmen in their classrooms view moral claims as mere opinions that are not true or are true only relative to a culture. So this is the kind of thing you end up with when you have somebody like Richard Dawkins out there making the claims that he is. He says, the gentleman writing this article says, what I didn't know was where this attitude came from. He says, given the presence of moral relativism in some academic circles, some people might naturally assume that philosophers themselves are to blame, but they aren't. He says, besides, if students are already showing up to college with this view of morality, it's very unlikely it's a result of what professional philosophers are teaching. So he went in search of what's actually driving this, and he says, a few weeks ago, I learned that students are exposed to this sort of thinking well before crossing the threshold of higher education. He went to visit his son's second grade open house, and he found a troubling pair of signs hanging over the bulletin board in the classroom. These are the two signs. Fact, something that is true about a subject and can be tested or proven. Or opinion, what someone thinks, feels, or believes. Now, he says that hoping that this set of definitions was kind of a mistake, he went home and Googled that fact versus opinion. And he says the definitions he found online were substantially the same as what he saw in his son's classroom. And he says, as it turns out, the Common Core standards used by a majority of the school programs in the country require that students be able to distinguish among fact, opinion, and reasoned judgment in a text. And the Common Core Institute provides a page that has links to definitions of these, along with the lesson plans and quizzes and everything else, to ensure that students can tell the difference between facts and opinions. So what's wrong with this distinction, and how does it undermine the view that there are objective moral facts? Well, he says, first, the definition of a fact, the way they have it described, waffles between truth and proof. Two obviously different features there. Things can be true even if no one can prove them. For example, it would be true that there's life elsewhere even though no one can prove it. That could be a fact. Conversely, many of the things we once proved turn out to be false. So even if you could prove it, it doesn't mean it's true. It's a mistake to confuse truth with proof. And he says, furthermore, if proof is required for facts, then facts become person relative. So it's always relative to whatever the person thinks. He says, worse, students are taught that claims are either facts or opinions. They're given quizzes in which they must sort claims into one camp or the other, but not both. They can't even make the decision to say, well, that's both an opinion and truth. But he says, if a fact is something that is true, an opinion is something to believe, then many claims should be both. For example, he asked his son about distinction at the open house, and his son confidently explained that facts were things that were true, whereas opinions are things that are believed. So he had this particular conversation with his son. He says, I believe that George Washington was the first president. Is that fact or opinion? And his son said, well, it's a fact. He says, but I believe it. And he said that what someone believes is an opinion. And his response was, yeah, but it's true. So it's both a fact and an opinion. And his son just stared at him with a blank face, not able to really solve that problem. But this is what they're teaching him. Here's some of the things that a test that they devised on fact versus opinion are the following facts or opinions. Copying homework assignments is wrong. Cursing in school is inappropriate behavior. All men are created equal. It is worth sacrificing some personal liberties to protect our country from terrorism. It is wrong for people under the age of 21 to drink alcohol. Vegetarians are healthier than people who eat meat. And drug dealers belong in prison. So what are those? Are they facts or opinions, or is there a mix of those within that list? What do you think, Oscar? You're on the hook for...
Yeah, I mean, at first, you hear those things, and those are
okay.
Reality,
all men
right?
are created equal. Fact or opinion?
I think that's a principle.
Drug dealers belong in prison. Well, we'd have to put all the pharmacists in prison.
Walgreens.
all of them out there. Cursing in school is inappropriate behavior.
Define cursing. This stuff.
Well, the answer, in each case, the worksheets categorized all of these as opinions.
Right, okay.
The explanation on offer is that each of these claims, it's a value claim. And value claims are not fact.
Because people's values are all different.
Right. So
the funny thing is that...
claim with good, right, wrong, or whatever is not a fact, is what they're basically teaching in these common core values to determine what is fact and what is opinion. Anything that you can claim is good, right, or wrong cannot be a fact. It has to be an opinion. So the public schools are teaching these students that all claims are either facts or opinion, and that values and morals claims all fall into the opinion side of it.
Right. I mean, what's happening is that they're not giving any leeway for philosophy to be scientific at all, even though it's a study of, you know, something.
Yeah.
And so with philosophy, it's the same thing with the gay rights conversation that, well, science hasn't proven it. Well, but philosophically, you can prove things too, especially when you don't necessarily have the means to make experiential, get experimental data. But philosophically, you cannot have a conversation with someone if there is no such thing as absolute truth between the two people.
Right. And that's like...
It's just not possible.
And that's what I started out the show
with.
We
learned that in Philosophy 101.
You can't command somebody to be moral if their belief system never included it. And here... The schools are doing exactly that with the children. They're eliminating a set of moral beliefs,
right,
because those are a value system, and we shouldn't, like Richard Dawkins says, we shouldn't be forcing our values upon our children. So more of the crazy culture that doesn't want to look at the fact that there needs to be morality in order for things to progress. They think they progress without any values. We'll be right back.
popular kids. You'll never guess what Jessica did. So I guessed I'm straight. And the only thing that matters is climbing up that social ladder. Still care about your hair and the car you drive. Doesn't matter if you're 16 or 35. Reese Witherspoon, she's the prom queen. Bill Gates, captain of the chess team. Jack Black, the clown. Brad Pitt, the quarterback. Seen it all before.
Seems like maybe it still is high school. We're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. This came out this past week, and in UCLA, there's a debate over a Jewish student echoes the old biases on the campus. Seems like routine business for the student council at UCLA, confirming the nomination of Rachel Beta, a second-year economics major who wants to be a lawyer someday, has caused a lot of problems there. Things were good until it came time for questions. One of the existing members of the council asked her, given that you are a Jewish student and very active in the Jewish community, this is from Fabian Roth, a member of the council, looking at her, how do you see yourself being able to maintain an unbiased view? Well, for the next 40 minutes after she was dispatched from the room, the council tangled in a debate about whether her faith and affiliation with Jewish organizations, including her sorority, meant that she would be biased in dealing with sensitive governance questions that came before the board, which is, at least on their campus, the campus equivalent of the Supreme Court. The discussion was actually recorded in written minutes, captured on video. The video was up on YouTube at one point, but got pulled off, so people were a little bit concerned about the results of what was being discussed there. But the council, the actual meeting took place back in the 10th of February, and they voted at first to reject her nomination with four of the members against her. And then at the prodding of a faculty advisor there who pointed out that belonging to a Jewish organization was not a conflict of interest, the students revisited the question and unanimously put her on the board. And I would say that from Proverbs 15:32, he says, he who disdains instruction despises his own soul, but he who heeds rebuke gets understanding. Well, I guess that rebuke for these students kind of helped them. They got a little bit of understanding and afterwards revoted, and they voted to put her on the council. Well, there's been a uproar about the fact that these students went and basically had anti-Semitic viewpoints towards her, even though at no point in time did they make any comments about Israel. They were very much questioning the fact that as a Jew or Jewish person that she would be able to be not have a conflict of interest in her seat there. Well, it turns out that they had to actually go out and send a letter to the UCLA students through the UCLA newspaper apologizing for their behavior. Now, there's, like I said, there's four of these students that were involved in this, and they didn't really go into the individual students' backgrounds, but two of them, one of them by the name of Negan Sadiga Mova Head, and the other one, Sofia Moreno Hawk, were actually two transfer students that had come to UCLA, and were just recently, back in November, put on the board. Well, they had written a letter to the UCLA newspaper back in November. And they've claimed stated in this article that they both have decided to join forces and become running mates in the fall election for these exact same seats. It says, our experiences at UCLA have been similar. This is the very beginning of the article that they, or the letter that they write to the Daily Bruin. They say, our experiences at UCLA have been very similar. We are two Muslim women of color who have dealt with the transfer process and the culture shift of coming from community colleges to this large institution. We are dedicated to a high moral ground of progressive politics with aspirations to represent those who, like ourselves, are underrepresented. We envision an equitable UCLA. Now, that's from their letter back in November. Now they were put on the board, and the result is that they initially wanted not to bring this other young lady on simply because of her Jewish association. So there seems to be a lot different viewpoint in the way they should be represented and what their backgrounds are. They clearly made it stated in their letter that, like I said, their very almost first or second sentence in the second paragraph is, we're two Muslim women of color. So they're very specific about what their race is and what their religious affiliation is, but they say nothing at that point in time what their credentials are with regards to why they should be allowed to be on the board. Whereas this young lady came in initially entirely based on her credentials and was attacked solely because of her religious affiliation by these two people. So that's two of the four. One of the other ones that was attacking them also and saying he didn't want him on there was a young man by the name of Majant Singh, who also had written an article for the Daily Bruin back about a year and a half ago. And he writes that he was 8 years old at the time of the September 11th attacks in 2001. I was in third grade. And his submission was titled, Americans Should Look Beyond Differences at Individual. And he says, before I could even understand what was going on, kids at school began to put me into categories based on the turban I wore as a Sikh. They gave me labels that had nothing to do with who I was, calling me Osama's son, terrorist, or Al-Qaeda. Well, here's a guy that should be more than willing to allow somebody on the board, vote for him, and ignore their religious background if he was so traumatized or affected by the fact that kids did that to him when he was young. Yet here he is, one of those four, claiming that she shouldn't be on the board purely because she was Jewish. So they were all required to write a letter of apology to the Daily Bruin, apologizing. And the interesting aspect of this is they're all still sitting on the board. You kind of wonder, is it because of their background that they're not getting the heat that somebody else would if they were to do the same kind of thing? So more of that education system that seems to be causing a very confusing culture out there. We'll be right back with more Solomon on Blast.
Join the line, and with her head upon his shoulder,
We're back with our one Greater Than Solomon segment here on Solomon on Blast, Power Talk 1210. Billy, don't be a hero. We've talked last couple weeks about the different people that are going over to the Middle East, Syria, to fight for ISIS, and the crazy things that they're doing, the young people that they're attracting through social media and whatnot. Well, here's a little different aspect to it. In this article, an American soldier of Christ fights ISIS on front lines in obedience to Christ's command to defend the weak. Psalm 82:3 says, "Defend the weak and the fatherless, uphold the cause of the poor and the oppressed." Well, a young military veteran from Detroit, Michigan, known as a soldier of Christ, is serving on the front lines to defeat the Islamic State terror group in obedience to Jesus' command to protect the poor and oppressed. In this article, he says, "People ask me, why you? I come back and I say, why not? Why just me? Where's everyone else at?" He's a U.S. Army veteran known only as Brett, and despite being severely wounded while serving in Iraq in 2006 and 2007, the young soldier says he's not afraid of once again facing the enemy. Jesus says, "You know, what you do unto the least of them, you do unto me." "I take that very seriously," Brett said, adding that he came to Iraq to serve all who are defenseless, Christian and non-Christian alike. Islamic State militants have targeted religious minorities throughout the Middle East, particularly the Christian and the Yazidis, since overtaking large regions of both Iraq and Syria this past year. It says that thousands of believers have been driven from their homes or murdered by the extremist groups. And they've vowed to cleanse the region of religions other than Islam. And additionally, hundreds of Christian women and children have been raped, tortured, or sold into slavery. But somebody like Brett here has taken the word of God, the command of Christ, to heart. He says he was raised a Roman Catholic, but identifies simply as Christian, and he's currently fighting alongside a small local Christian militia called the Dawit Nausha. The group relies on donations from Christian charities abroad and wealthier members of the Iraqi Assyrian community for their weapons, and they're actually under the command of a Kurdish Peshmerga force in Iraq. Their goal is to reclaim territory from the terrorist groups and allow Christians and other minorities to return to their homes. The leader of the group says, "We came here to protect our Christian brothers and their homes. There's constant cooperation and assistance, and we always work together." That's taking the word of God to heart and the commandments of Christ. And that, for him, is thinking wisely. So until next week, we appreciate all your listeners, and we'll see you next week.